So I will present my work. I orientated my presentation in terms of WH questions, I think, which students might be aware of. The why I did this, what was involved in my work, and of course how I proceeded once I decided what I was going to do, and of course finally why, what for, what were the results of this work that I carried out. So that's the introductory phrase there. So I'm going to move on to the first question. The first question is, of course, why I decided to undertake this this publication project. As I said, I was very, as I've already said, I'm interested in voyaging manuscripts and the recent focus on travel texts. And as far as late 18th century voyaging to the South Seas is concerned, this interest in unmediated text was addressed, for example, recently by John Dunmore, well, relatively recently, in 2002. And John Dunmore published, translated Louis de Bougainville's voyaging account, and the previous translation had appeared in 1772 by Forster. So Dunmore looked at Louis de Bougainville's texts, unmediated texts, his journals, his logbooks, and decided to translate his work there. Another example of this type of work was the transcription this time, so that was a translation here, a transcription of George Tobin's manuscript. Now, Roy Schreiber transcribed George Tobin's manuscript, and George Tobin was master on William Bligh's second voyage to the Pacific. Now, you all know William Bligh and his mutiny, of course, but then, of course, William Bligh, once he got back to England, went off again to Polynesia, present-day Polynesia, and George Tobin was master on this second voyage, and Roy Schreiber looked at this manuscript and transcribed it. Another example of, as I said, this recent rekindling of interest in unmediated text was the publication of James Morrison's account of the mutiny, so William Bligh's first voyage, which appeared in 2013. So these publications, transcriptions and translations were and still are representative of the demand for Pacific voyaging texts and context in English. So that was the field I was working in, and I wanted to pursue that in my publication project. But I was a little bit... I was thinking, well, most of the texts have been made available. The primary sources are there. The Hakluyt Society has been publishing. So what texts exist which haven't yet been made available? And I decided that perhaps I would look at, especially where the Pacific was concerned, I would look at texts which predated James Cook's voyages to the Pacific, because most of the focus, most of the scholarship was on James Cook and his journals and his mediated and unmediated text. And so, and of course James Cook, his tremendous achievements explain why the focus was on James Cook. But before James Cook, there was a substantial prologue taking place in terms of theory and practice. And Tom Ryan, a scholar from New Zealand, has suggested that some of that prologue, and from a theoretical perspective, was looking at... for example, Navigation aux Terres Australes, okay, which was published in 1756 by Charles de Brosse. And this 1756 publication, well before Cook, 10 years before, was translated into English by a Scotsman whose name is Callender. And this translation was extremely interesting, because there are many, many differences. And of course, what Callender did was take de Brosse's positions and transform them into English positions as far as the exploration of the Pacific Ocean is concerned. So that was part of the theoretical prologue before Cook. And the let's say the practice was also taking place. Well, let's say we could look at it from a practical point of view as well, because Samuel Wallace then, who is the navigator that I was going to focus on, was sent on a voyage around the world as a result of this theoretical discussion about exploration of the Pacific Ocean, which was made available to the deciding institutions through Callender's translation. So, and what was interesting about Samuel Wallace's voyage was that the texts from Samuel Wallace's voyages was never actually published. It had never been made available. We knew all about James Cook. We knew about his voyages. We knew about his journals, his logs. We knew about Hawkesworth and so on and so forth. But Wallace was relatively not very well known. So I thought, well, okay, I could focus on Wallace because his voyage was extremely important because he was the first to discover Tahiti. Now, Tahiti was going to be extremely important for James Cook because it was going to be somewhere where he would be able to stop on his voyage around the Pacific and so it was an extremely important site for example, obtaining food and water so that Cook could then carry on with his voyages and crisscross the Pacific and make his discoveries. But Cook did not discover Tahiti, Samuel Wallace did. So I started to become interested in Samuel Wallace. And one of the questions that came to the fore was that why weren't the Dolphin. So his ship was HMS Dolphin and Samuel Wallace was the captain, the commander. It was a two-ship expedition. And so my question was, why weren't his texts published? And one of the explanations that I came up with was that, in fact, he didn't actually write a journal. Wallace himself didn't write a journal. Whereas Byron, who had gone before him, had, and James Cook, who was going to come after him, also wrote a journal, but Wallace did not. All that appeared to be available for the Dolphin voyage were the logbooks. And logbooks are documents where the entries are rather more cursory than in a redacted journal. So that was perhaps one of the major reasons why the Wallace texts weren't published. Perhaps also they were considered as being minor at the time, because immediately afterwards, Wallace came back to England in 68 and James Cook set off immediately afterwards. And when Cook came back, he brought with him drawings and paintings and journals. So the sources that he brought back were a lot more important and interesting. And the only published relation of Wallace's voyage was in Hawkesworth. Okay, so is it? Do I do it with this? No, not working. Juste avant c'est ici.
C'est bizarre.
Sorry.
Should be working.
Okay, that's it. Okay, thank you. Merci, Monsieur Bernard.
Well, I think the arrow here should be working.
Okay, thank you.
I'm sorry about that.
No, that's fine, thank you. Oh, I need to go back. Thank you. Thank you. So the only reference to the Wallace voyage was published in Hawkesworth's compilation in 1773, and Hawkesworth wrote up an account of this voyage, but it was an extremely fictionalised account and did not really refer to the logbooks as such. And so for decades, Hawkesworth's reworked account of the Dolphin's voyage became the account of this 1766-1768 voyage. And as I said, it was an extremely fictionalised account, and there was never any, correction of Hawksworth's opinions of this, and because they really were opinions. When you read Hawksworth's account of what Wallis voyage, it has absolutely nothing to do with what Wallis actually said about his own voyage. So there is, but it was never corrected. So the idea was that, okay, perhaps then for me, my focus could be a transcription of the Wallis texts, even if they were only logbooks. Now, they're until the, let's say the 1980s, the focus on logbooks was extremely limited, because logbooks by the Hakluyt Society were considered as very dry, indigestible material. That's how they were described by some of the authors. For example, on the Dolphin, the master was George Robertson. And George Robertson wrote a journal, and his journal was published by the Hakluyt Society, and this was the only other publication relating to the Dolphin voyage. And the person who published the transcription of George Robertson's voyage, said, "Well, we're not interested in looking at the logbooks because it's such dry material." So, of course. By saying this in the introduction, and you all know, I don't know if you have looked at any of the Hakluyt publications, they have really very quite substantial introductions. This became an accepted process. Let's not look at the logbooks, they're not important. What is important is the actual journal. So this, of course, overlooks the fact that George Robertson rewrote his journal with a view to publication. So I feel that Carrington was just a little bit, he neglected some aspects of Robertson's work. And then in the 90s, there was, as I said, a rekindling of scholarship on the unmediated text. And for example, Clive Wilkinson, he's one of the important figures there, says that looking at the dry contents in logs provides, and I'm quoting from Wilkinson, a striking impression of the vastness and emptiness of oceans, which is imperceptible in edited or published accounts. So there was a refocusing on the logbook. So that was my, if you like, justification of why I was going to focus on the Wallis logbooks in these publications. These were missing links in the history of the Pacific, and these missing links were going to provide new perspectives on the dry and indigestible material which was a description given to the logbooks. So that was the first volume. Remember, we're still in the why. I was going to focus on. And so after Wallis, if you know a little bit about the history of the exploration of the Pacific Ocean, came Cook and his three voyages, came William Bligh, etc. And there was an extremely developed policy of exploration of the Pacific right up until the end of the 18th century. By the 90s, by the 1790s, the Pacific was a known area. It was no longer a blank space on the map. And so it was all the more surprising for me. Remember, I was still looking at what I would focus on as far as unmediated text was concerned. So I was very surprised to see that French voyager Étienne Marchand, who travelled around the world and in his journal claimed to have discovered the Marquises Islands, les îles Marquises aujourd'hui, his journal of his voyage around the world had remained unpublished until Odile Gagné's 2005 transcription. So Odile Gagné produced an extremely brilliant transcription of this is Odile Gagné's absolutely brilliant transcription of Étienne Marchand's journal, and which hadn't been published right up until 2005. But this unmediated text had been published. Now my idea was, well, has it been translated into English? Because it was in French, obviously, and it hadn't been translated into English. So I decided that I would go full circle, going from the prologue, Wallis, right, as far as the exploration of the Pacific was concerned, going right through to the epilogue, right at the end of the 18th century, to Étienne Marchand, and I would translate Odile Gagné's, Marchand's journal that Odile Gagné had transcribed in this wonderful book that she produced in 2005 with Sissy Bidquant. So, in doing this transcription and in doing this translation, I would try to fill the gaps and I would try to identify the redactive mechanisms from that archaeological approach that I developed right at the beginning there. So the next question was how to go about actually gaining access to these sources. So that's the next question, how. We've looked at why and what. Now we're on to the how we were going to do this. The Marchand manuscript is held at the Alcazar Library in Marseille. And Odile Gagné had transcribed the manuscript. So this was easy access for me. So that was settled. I would have access to the Marchand journal, thanks to Odile Gagné and Cécile Bécoin, and thanks to the actual manuscript. I went to Marseille and photographed the whole manuscript, and this is just a photograph of the first page of Marchand's first volume. And so how to go about transcribing? I had access to this source. This was not going to be a problem. But for Wallis, this proved over the years, because it took almost 2 years for me to get access to the epilogue books, proved to be extremely, extremely difficult. Now, I started doing my archival research. I tried to identify the logs. Remember, I mentioned the publication of George Robertson's journal of the Dolphin Voyage, and this publication was by Carrington, Hugh Carrington. And Carrington mentions one logbook. So, of course, I identified the logbook, and this logbook was held at the Mitchell Library in New South Wales, in Sydney, in Australia. So that was one log. And as I started to go through, just to make sure there was only one log, because often these logs were copied as time went on, so I was making sure that I had access to all the logs, I realised over time that, in fact, there were four logs, and which were all different. So one log was held in Sydney, another one was in Wellington in New Zealand, and another one, so two, sorry, were held in at the Mitchell, another one in Wellington, and another one in London at the British Library. So that was a finding in itself, because so far it had been considered that there'd only been one single log from the Dolphin Voyage. So this was quite interesting in itself, because going through all these catalogues, I realised that I had all these different logs to look at. And of course, looking at these logs, which I labelled in my book, I had to work out which one I considered had been written first, in situ, on the ship. And then which ones were copies, and then which ones were copies after the copy, and so on and so forth. So that was a really interesting process, and I had to gain access to all these logs and compare them. And so actually, at that time, they weren't online. They are now. But I had to go to Australia, and I had to go to New Zealand, and of course I had to go to London, which was easy, and I was looking at these copies. So, and I worked out which might perhaps, in time to come, people might say, well, no, that's not the first one. But I worked out the chronological order. I considered that one of the logs was the first one, was the original, and the next one was copy. And I based my conclusions on the differences in the contents, first of all, and in the formatting. Because the first log, there were watermarks everywhere, it was extremely cursory, there were crossings out. So that was one of my, you know, reasons. Those were the reasons why I considered that was the first log. And the second log was very neat and was copied word for word. And the third log was completely rewritten, and it was in the copper plate, whereas the other script was not, and so on and so forth. So I worked out these, so I tried to work out chronology. And of course, while I was working out the chronology, my archaeological metaphor came into play because I realised that there were huge differences, even in the notes, even though in the note form from the first to the second to the third to the fourth log. So there was this, so Samuel Wallace signed all the logs, but that doesn't mean that he actually wrote them. They were all in the same handwriting, except the copperplate script log, and but there are annotations in that log which I consider those were annotations made by Wallace himself. And so I realised that there was a redactive mechanism which had come into play, and the first impressions were transformed into second impressions, were transformed into third impressions, and so on and so forth. And the discursive stances and the discursive values of these texts changed as the copies were made. So in my book, what I have done is I transcribed the first log, and all the differences appear in the footnotes to the book. Mm. So that was one extremely interesting perspective, that there was an archaeology in these texts to be identified, even if the signatory was the same. Okay. So while I was looking at these sources, I discovered these logs, and I also discovered a whole series of iconographical, a lot of iconographical material, which hadn't yet been published at all. So as time went on, as I was doing my research, as I said, it took me two or three years to do, I realised that there were sets of drawings in Sydney. There were another set of drawings from, all signed by Samuel Wallace this time, so they really were done by Wallace. And another set of drawings in New Zealand, another in London, and so on and so forth. And I realised that the same process was identifiable in the drawings. They went from sketches to more elaborate drawings, and then they went on to drawings that were destined for publication and which carried different discursive messages compared to the original drawings. So so this was an extremely long and complicated process. So, and these drawings, as I said, these series of drawings, only one of those series had actually been studied, and so the others were going to be new material for the book. And so I could say that that was the process of the books that of my publication project, and you've gone through the why, the what, and how. And now, of course, what I'd like to suggest is, well, what did I, you know, what were the major findings? And as I've said, there was a change in the discursive stance, and for example, in Marchand, I realised there were not, he didn't draw a lot, but he did draw a bit. And in fact, what he did was that he copied Cook. He copied Cook's drawings. So this is Marchand's drawing of Marquesian artifacts. This is the publication that appeared in Cook. This is the publication relating to Cook's second voyage and his and the drawing, not Cook's voyages, but not Cook's drawings, but the drawings that came back with the voyage. And of course, what Marchand did was he produced his drawings, which he inserted into his journal, and without any labelling or without any reference to the source. And of course, if you compare, you see. And of course, it's very, very clear in Marchand that he had read very, very widely. He has an extremely, and Odile Gagné's very approach to this was very interesting. She made a list of all the books that she thought that he had on board ship with him. So it's extremely interesting to see, and from time to time, he actually references certain voyages, but in the drawing, he does not. And so it's a shame, because he claimed to have discovered the Northwest Marquesas, but in we won't talk about it here, but while I was translating his journal, I realised that he deliberately hid the fact that he knew very well that he hadn't discovered them, but he pretended that he had. And he sent a letter from China to France saying that he had discovered a new archipelago that he called the Îles de la Révolution, mais il savait très bien qu'il ne les avait pas découvertes parce qu'il a rencontré le vrai découvreur en Chine en même temps qu'il y était en train de vendre ses ports. So this archaeology, if you remember what I said at the beginning, translating did just not mean translating a text. It also meant tracing the origins of what was being produced. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the text of Marchand, you will see also that he copied in a very sort of creative way from his predecessors. And I think we often focus on descriptions of peoples. But what I noticed in Marchand as well, that he was a merchant seaman. This was a commercial voyage. And he so very wanted to be a real explorer. And what he and his descriptions of the birds, for example, that he wrote, were translating them was an absolute nightmare. But I did try to translate them, and I realised that by looking at the treatises that were published on the birds and so on and so forth at that time, that he'd obviously read Buffon, for example. He transposed the methods of describing birds into his journal. So I find it difficult to say that he copied, but he did. But I think that there was an intent there that was extremely interested. And he did actually catch the birds. He dissected them and he described them, even though the way he described them was very similar to the way Buffon described his birds. So those are the findings as far as this work was concerned. And in Wallis, for example, I said I discovered a whole series of drawings. So this, for example, to trace back, if we're looking back, if we're taking the archaeological perspective, this was the first drawing of what is called the Queen's House. And this was a map of Tahiti, where the Queen's House was. And so I think you can see it on this map. Hang on, I'm not sure if you can see it clearly. Where is it? Okay, I can't see it clearly, but it's on one of these maps. I can't see it here. But this was the first map that he drew. Then he drew a drawing of the Queen's House. And then he drew this view of the bay with the ship and the Queen's House, which is here, okay. And then this was his final drawing of the Queen's House, and you see that he has added the Queen, okay, and he has added himself, okay, a tiny little figure, okay, there at the end. And of course, so this was Wallis drawing up his voyage, and do you see the different stances that he was taking? And of course, when Hawkesworth published the Wallis account, this is what became of the Wallis drawing. But I'm not sure that Hawkesworth actually had access to all the drawings either. But here you say a representation, this is the actual labelling of the drawing, representation of the surrender of the island of Otaheite to Captain Wallis. But this there never was really any surrender, and this episode never took place according to the logs. So those were the findings. There were many more, but obviously I can't give you all the examples, but I've just given you a few sort of key examples there. So I think that in conclusion, we can say that translation and transcription from other than a translation studies perspective can enable an archaeology of the narrative, and which for me means tracing the origins and the sources and excavating the remains of previous part or past narrative, in image as well as in text. And I don't think we can say that excavating those remains is simply noting down or observing, copying. It's there were different agendas, personal agendas, mm-hmm. as well as political agendas, and there has to be an overall approach to understanding a voyage and the textual artifact once you undertake this archaeology. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Merci beaucoup à tous les deux pour ces présentations très claires et vivantes qui donnent à voir un peu le voyage derrière le voyage, le parcours de chercheur, le cheminement intellectuel que vous avez chacun suivi pour parvenir à vos ouvrages respectifs.